The Superfund program is charged with cleaning up hundreds of toxic waste sites across the United States. But what happens to all those contaminants once they have been pulled from the ground under Superfund sites? A lot, it turns out. A joint investigation by the Guardian U.S. and the Center for Investigative Reporting found that waste from toxic sites can crisscross the country, leaving its own legacy of environmental problems and, in some cases, even generating more toxic waste. Matt Drange is a business reporter, and Suzanne Rust is an environmental reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Their report, Toxic Trail, is the first accounting of the hidden impacts of the Superfund program, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Suzanne, you described the Superfund program as a shell game in which one environmental danger appears to be addressed, yet is moved somewhere else in the form of a new problem. When waste leaves the Superfund site, where does it often go?
Well, it was a question we were curious about. We had been looking at a site in Silicon Valley where companies like Intel, Fairchild, and Raytheon used to make semiconductor chips. And they have it's one of the most well-monitored, well-observed Superfund sites in the country. And we had done a report on it about a year ago. There were some toxic vapors leaking up into what is now a Google building. And we were told by the EPA that this was a great site, that they had removed 100,000 pounds of toxic chemicals over the past 25 years. And we asked the simple question, well, that's amazing. Where do those chemicals go once you remove them? And what we discovered was an undocumented, which we now have documented, trail, which includes pumping these chemicals out. The act of pumping creates greenhouse gases, then moving those chemicals to treatment plants all over the country, from California to as far away as Kentucky to Pennsylvania. And then those chemicals there are treated, and they're put to really, really high temperatures, like almost 2,000 degrees. Once you put these kinds of chemicals under that heat, new chemicals are created, such as dioxins, which the EPA considers one of the dirty dozen persistent chemicals in the environment. And then again, those chemicals are trapped and shipped on somewhere else. And it's just this merry-go-round of toxic waste where they just move one problem to the next place, to the next place, to the next place.
Matt, how large and complex is this system for disposing of toxic waste?
It's probably larger than anyone even understands. I mean, the Superfund program feeds into what the EPA calls its hazardous waste disposal program, which is monitored very piecemeal. And so what we found is that often when this waste is sent off-site, it really just enters the system, and you can't really track it beyond one step.
Because it keeps on being moved from site to site?
That's correct. It keeps on being moved from site to site. And as Suzanne said, I mean, the treatment creates its own waste streams that then have to be sent somewhere else. And so the EPA really doesn't even have a good handle for when waste leaves, where it could ultimately end up.
Suzanne, you focus on a site in Mountain View. That's the one that we were talking about. How toxic was that site?
Like back in the 1980s, it was considered fairly toxic. There were these volatile organic chemicals that got into the ground. Soil was removed. Those chemicals eventually leaked down into the groundwater. And subsequently, the EPA has closed off the groundwater for drinking. Nobody can drink it there. But over time, they've removed almost 100,000 pounds of these chemicals. Today, the risk is fairly low. The vapors from these chemicals can leak into buildings above, sort of like radon does. However, there are manageable ways of treating that, including using just an air conditioner all the time or a heating system to flush out the air. But what we found when we started looking into this was we asked sort of that very simple question of, all right, well, we know they're moving the waste and they're creating new problems by removing it, but is the cost of doing that, does that outweigh the benefit of actually removing these chemicals at this current site? And what we discovered is the site actually isn't being cleaned. So while they continue pumping and removing chemicals, if you just left it alone, those chemicals would be removed over time. However, if you continue pumping and treating and moving these chemicals off-site, at the current rate that the system is going, it's going to take another 700 years before the site actually gets clean.
Well, Matt, can you explain this pump-and-treat approach?
Yeah, absolutely. So pump and treat is the most common technology that the government relies on when it comes to cleaning up contaminated groundwater sites like this one. It's actually, the technology is older than the personal computer, and yet we found that it's still used at more than 450 Superfund sites currently, despite evidence going back to the 1980s and 1990s that once you reach a certain point, it's essentially ineffective.
And why would it take 700 years before the water would be drinkable? I would think that you'd be able to clean it a lot quicker.
So what happens is these chemicals not only leak from the surface down into the groundwater, they leak into the soil around the groundwater. So the groundwater sits in these beds of soil, and the chemicals get stuck in the soil. But as you begin to pump, you start sucking those chemicals out of the soil into the groundwater. If you had left it alone, those chemicals would break down naturally from the bacteria and minerals that exist in the soil and clay around there. But instead, by the very act of pumping it and trying to remove the chemicals from the groundwater, you pull those chemicals out of what they call storage and put them into the groundwater. So you keep creating a problem. You keep pulling and moving those chemicals into the groundwater, which you then have to remove.
I'm talking with Suzanne Rust and Matt Drange there. Report Toxic Trail is the first accounting of the hidden impacts of the Superfund program. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Matt, part of that pumping of the contaminated water involves putting them through carbon filters. So do the carbon filters become contaminated?
They do, and the best way I think for folks to think about it is just that it's essentially like the Brita filter on your kitchen faucet, where the water will be filtered through these, except much larger. So the water will be filtered through these 10,000-pound filters, and once they're full, which depends on the amount of chemicals in the ground and how fast you're pumping, they then become contaminated and have to be sent off as their own hazardous waste streams. And when they get to the other side, like I think Suzanne mentioned earlier, in Kentucky, for example, they're essentially burned and superheated at about 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Why can't they be just burned on site? Why do they have to be sent to Kentucky from California?
Well, so there are a handful of sites around the country that treat that are known as carbon regeneration sites, which treat this type of filter, which is again carbon, like your kitchen faucet. And so, at the site in Mountain View, they don't have an incinerator or giant furnace, essentially, to do this kind of work, and so they have to send it to somewhere that's equipped to do that.
And Suzanne, that is often the Calgon Carbon Corporation's Big Sandy plant.
That is correct. So that is one place that they send carbon to be regenerated. So essentially when you regenerate a carbon filter, what you're doing is you're heating up the filter so all the chemicals are removed, and then you can use the carbon again in the new filter.
Now, they also send it to an Indian reservation. Should I be surprised?
I don't know if you should be surprised or not, but they do. There is a Siemens plant in Arizona that is located on an Indian reservation. There's also a plant that takes carbon filters that are not hazardous in Oklahoma, which also sits on the border of an Indian reservation.
Now, okay, so they're burned at 2,000 degrees. Once they're burned, what are you left with?
You're essentially left with a big pile of toxic ash, and as well as the residual filters and scrubbers that are used to make sure that you capture the dangerous chemicals and things like dioxins before they're released into the atmosphere. And so at Calgon, they'll have trucks, just a constant flow of trucks, both coming in to drop off hazardous waste, and also trucks that come in, pick up hazardous waste, and then send it somewhere else.
And where are they sending that toxic ash, which often includes mercury, doesn't it?
So it includes mercury if you included mercury in the first process. And if mercury came in, and some of that ash could include mercury, but that's actually further down the line. So what we found is that Calgon sends the bulk of its ash to a company called EQ, Environmental Quality, and they run a plant in Belleville, Michigan, which is both a landfill and a treatment plant. And so the Calgon plant will send its stuff about 300 miles north to that one.
Now, Suzanne, I'm quoting you. You say, for every 5 pounds of waste that arrives here, an additional pound of waste is created that needs to be shipped to a different plant. So what are we saying? 5 pounds become 6 pounds?
Well, I think we're talking about the Calgon plant. 5 pounds comes into Calgon, And then just by through the byproduct of treating it, you've created this ash, you've created these scrubbers that are now contaminated. You have now, yes, created 1 pound of hazardous waste that then has to go on elsewhere. I mean, the point there being that, you know, we think of waste as going somewhere and being treated, and then that waste is gone. That's not what happens. New waste is then created, which then has to be sent on somewhere else to be treated.
How many places before it finally stops being sent somewhere?
Well, if you can answer that question, we would really appreciate it. But right now it looks like it just keeps going on and on, right? So once you get to this place in Michigan where they have their own treatment plant and their landfill, they have to start treating all of the stuff that they create as a byproduct. And then they have places that they send it to. And suddenly you've got what almost like if you were to look at a map, it would look like fire burst, just like fireworks sort of exploding all over the places. You go from one place and then they might send their waste to 7 different places. And then those places send it to 7 to 20 different places and so on and so forth. And it almost seems like it never stops. It just keeps getting moved around and around and around.
Now, Matt, I mentioned that some of these plants are on Indian reservations. I get the sense that waste from Superfund sites is being shipped and treated to parts of the country that have less political and economic clout.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly got the sense, too, with this story. I mean, I should say, you know, we didn't look at all the sites. There are about 850 sites that fit the same sort of general characteristics as the collection of sites that we looked at in Silicon Valley. But, I mean, certainly in this case, when you think of Silicon Valley as having some of the most wealthy individuals and expensive property in the country, if not the world, it is interesting that a lot of it ends up like where we were in rural eastern Kentucky, where a lot of people, you know, never went to college, and the average house, I think, costs about $40,000 or $50,000. It's definitely a dichotomy that we found interesting.
And do the people who live in these communities face any danger from the fact that there's a toxic treatment plant near them?
They could. I mean, the people in Kentucky that we looked at, for example, they're almost immune at this point to all of these heavy industrial processes going on around them. They have a large, very large oil refinery just down the street. And the way they see it is that as long as the smoke coming out of the stacks at this Calgon plant is white, they're okay. But there certainly are risks, and there are risks that aren't being measured. So Suzanne mentioned earlier this issue of dioxins. Dioxins are released from plants like Calgon, and yet we don't actually, because neither the company nor the EPA actively go out and measure them on a consistent basis. We don't actually know how many are even out there or how many are getting into the food supply.
How hazardous are dioxins?
As I said earlier, the EPA considers them one of the scariest chemicals out there. I mean, essentially, they get into the food that we eat. They then get into our bodies, and they've been sort of tied with all things like cancer and birth defects, and I mean, you name it. They're really nasty chemicals, and the EPA has been working really hard over the past 20 to 30 years to reduce the amount of dioxins that we are exposed to. So it was surprising for us to discover that at these carbon regeneration plants, nobody has even looked to see how much dioxin has been coming out of them. I think it was the last study was done in 1989, which was a big surprise.
And you note that dioxins can end up in us. I was surprised to learn that the Inuit who live in the Arctic Circle have the highest concentrations of contaminants, including dioxins, in their bodies. How is it possible when they live so far from the places that are creating all of this waste?
Well, so dioxins are a really interesting chemical. They're one of these chemicals that sort of, when they're emitted from a place like a carbon regeneration plant, they sort of trickle down into the water or onto the trees and the grass and everything sort of around. And then animals will come eat those. And then another animal will come in and eat that animal. And the chemical sort of concentrates as it moves up into the food chain. So it can get into fish, for instance, and then move into, you know, something like a shark or into a whale or into a seal. And so that's part of how it gets up into people like the Inuit, who eat a very high, fatty, meat-rich diet. The foods they're eating are just filled with dioxins because it's at the top of the food chain. The other thing is dioxins move with ocean currents and wind currents. So there was a study done, I believe it was last year, in the journal, I think it was Nature, where you could just, they modeled sort of how dioxins move around the globe. And so even though dioxins may be created in a heavily industrialized area, you'll find sort of the effects of those dioxins sort of further down the jet stream where the winds have pushed them. So they just migrate around the globe.
My guests are Suzanne Rust and Matt Drange of the Center for Investigative Reporting. Their report, done jointly with the U.S. Guardian, is called Toxic Trail, and we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll look into some more of these frightening stories after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Matt Drange and Suzanne Rust of the Center for Investigative Reporting, who have done a joint report with the U.S. Guardian called Toxic Trail. And we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. In describing what happens at these waste treatment plants, you kind of suggested that they have their own environmental violations. So do we see environmental treatment plants then becoming Superfund sites as well?
You could. I mean, it's interesting you asked that. I mean, the EPA has a rule set up called the off-site rule, and the way that works is that Superfund waste is not supposed to go to plants that have had serious egregious violations. But we found that often, even after a plant will correct an issue, or even while they're still, while the correction is still ongoing, you know, they're still trying to fix their problems, they can accept Superfund waste, and the EPA either isn't looking or will look the other way. And so we found many cases where plants have had violations of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and yet receive thousands of pounds of Superfund waste every year.
Are they penalized at the same time?
Well, so they're penalized if they get one of these off-site rule notices. But it really, the way the EPA sees it and what they've told us is that it's really just a business liability protection tool. It's not an enforcement tool. And so the EPA really just leaves it to these companies essentially to go check the plants that they send their waste to and do their own homework. The problem is that often either the companies won't do their homework or they really just will send waste wherever they want, regardless of their environmental documented violations.
And don't some of these companies actually lose track of their shipments?
Occasionally, yeah.
Or dump them in the river instead of going to the next process.
Yes. So Calgon has had problems with leaking waste into the river. A couple incidents. The most recent, I believe, was in September of 2011, and they were fined for that. And the state did come, and talk to them about it. I believe actually the employee who was responsible for it got fired. But there are certainly other cases at many other plants. You know, we're talking about thousands of plants here. This is just one of them. But at many other plants where, you know, maybe the disposal is not adequate and is potentially dangerous.
And Suzanne, they are the ones who determine, the plants themselves determine when waste can be labeled hazardous or non-hazardous?
Yeah, so actually, when back to the original Superfund site, the companies that are responsible for cleaning that up, it is up to them to decide where they're going to send their waste and whether they're going to determine that waste is hazardous or not. And what was, I think, most fascinating to us as we looked into this, it's not like every time they send out waste, they go to test to see whether it's hazardous or not. About once every 2 years, they decide, is all of our waste for the next 2 years going to be hazardous, yes or no? And then, depending on that, they will send it to a treatment plant, let's say, in Pennsylvania versus Oklahoma.
Go ahead.
So it's all sort of up to the what they're called responsible parties at the Superfund sites to decide, again, how to label the waste and then who to send it to.
The EPA says that the handful of Superfund treatment plants are significant sources of dioxins, but doesn't require the plants to report releases of the chemicals, and regulators haven't researched the problem since 1987?
That is correct. So, again, they have the EPA puts out a report about every 5 or 6 years that documents what are the significant dioxin sources in the country, and carbon regeneration plants are routinely on that list. And the other interesting thing is the EPA is really, really concerned about dioxins, and they say that right now the level of dioxins that we find in our food chains, the foods we eat today, are uncomfortably close to those levels that cause problems in laboratory animals. So it's really a problem, and it's really a surprise that at these carbon regeneration sites, these companies are not required to report the emissions coming out of their plants every year.
Now, before I read this piece, I hadn't thought much about what happens to the waste from a Superfund site in terms of how it's shipped. Are they mostly shipped on trucks, on trains?
Both. Primarily, it's on the backs of diesel trucks. And so, you know, Calgon trucks, for example, they're these big blue trucks with the white logo emblazoned on the side. And they look similar to, I guess, what you would think of as a small oil tanker, in that there's this, you know, it's on the back of an 18-wheeler.
A round tank.
Oh, yes, exactly. A round tank and going all around the country. It's just part of this bigger system. I mean, there are millions of pounds of hazardous waste shipped around the country every day, some of it starting at Superfund sites, some of it starting at factories, other waste or military or government sites, you name it.
Have there been any accidents?
There are, actually, and we didn't really get into that in this story too much, but there are a number of hazardous material accidents every year, and they get documented to some extent by the Department of Transportation. And some of them do involve Superfund sites. We just didn't look, for this story at least, we might for the next one, didn't look at exactly how many incidents are the direct result of Superfund waste.
No, you mentioned – you go ahead, Suzanne.
I was just going to say, one of the most frustrating parts about this story was, I think when we initially looked into this, we thought – we'd be able to do this fabulous graphic sort of showing trucks going around the country all the time. You know, like you could almost see it as sort of like a Pac-Man display where you just see like dot, 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 you know, as they move across the highway system over and over again. But what we discovered is that the EPA, as Matt had said earlier, doesn't follow the waste shipments the way that would make it possible, right? So they follow it from the source to the first stop. And the first stop might be a place where a truck goes and then mixes it with other hazardous waste. But then the trail goes cold. And then a new trail starts. And it's just, it is impossible for the layperson, even for EPA officials that we spoke to actually follow waste around the country. And so what we did here was we had to look at sort of one case study that sort of exemplified this, because to do it everywhere, it would just be a Herculean task.
Now, Matt mentioned that they're put on diesel trucks. Is that an attempt to create a smaller carbon footprint?
I mean, I think it's the most cost-effective way. As it's set up right now, there are a handful of very large, or about three or four companies that make up the bulk of hazardous waste disposal companies. Clean Harbors is a big one. Environmental Quality that I mentioned earlier is another big one. But the other thing that we haven't talked about yet is just the enormous carbon footprint. So you mentioned that figure earlier, you know, for every 5 pounds of contaminants pulled from the ground, roughly 20,000 pounds of carbon dioxide are produced. A good chunk of that is actually just from the cross-country treks that these trucks take. I mean, when you're driving, you know, 2,000, 3,000 miles on the back of a big rig truck, getting maybe, what, 5-10 miles per gallon? I mean, it's an enormous cost, and one that the EPA knows is there but chooses not to quantify, and really, in most cases we found, really even do anything about it.
My guests are Matt Drange and Suzanne Rust of the Center for Investigative Reporting. We're talking about a report done in conjunction with The Guardian called Toxic Trail. And if you want to read it, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org, where we have a link. Your investigation found that as many as one-third of all Superfund sites could be causing more environmental harm than good. Is the federal government aware of this? Are they doing anything to get a handle on this problem?
I mean, they are aware of the problems with pump and treat, like I said earlier, and that it's largely ineffective at a more mature stage of a site. So after you've been cleaning it for 10, 15 years, the odds of pump and treat actually contributing anything significant in terms of waste removal are pretty slim. But the EPA has yet to do any sort of comprehensive study. They couldn't even tell us, for example, we had to put together our own database, Suzanne and I. They couldn't tell us how many sites even use pump and treat. I mean, the way that the EPA looks at its Superfund program, its landmark program, is on a site-by-site basis.
And why do you think that is? Is it just that they're underfunded or that they're pressured not to go any deeper into this because it's a political issue?
I don't know that they've been pressured. I wouldn't be surprised if there is some political pressure on this, no doubt. But I really think the issue isn't even so much funding as it is, it's just a myopic system. The EPA looks at one site as if it's the only site. So they don't go like we did, looking at this as a systemic problem of, hey, we're pulling this waste out of the ground, how we dispose of it matters. We can't just consider the job done when the waste is removed from the ground, because that's just the beginning.
But, Suzanne, are we being a little too hard on the EPA and on this industry? Haven't there been some major successes in cleaning up toxic waste sites and making areas livable again?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think neither Matt or I would deny that. There have been some really great examples of the EPA cleaning up sites. The other thing about pump and treat is that initially when you use it, like for the first 5 to 6 years, 5 to 10 years, the system does work well. It pulls contaminants out of the ground. The problem is you reach a point where, as we talked about earlier, where you have pulled so many chemicals out of the water that it's almost like an osmosis effect, right? There's sort of an evening effect, where the chemicals in the soils then start leaking into the groundwater, and it suddenly becomes a system that doesn't work anymore. It reaches this critical threshold, and then it stops working. And so I think what we're really pointing out is that the Superfund system has its place, right? It works really well at an initial cleanup, but then what needs to happen is the EPA has to say, are the resources we're putting into the system still worth it? And what we're pointing out is that at least in 450 cases or more, probably not. And instead, it's no longer benefiting the area that they're working at. It's creating costs elsewhere. So these greenhouse gas costs of using a pump and treat system or shipping cross-country or creating dioxins or just, you know, completely entering this waste stream. Suddenly, those costs really begin to outweigh the benefits of doing any more work at these sites. And when you think that 450 is about a third of these national priority Superfund sites, that seems like a pretty epic waste.
Your report doesn't deal with New York's two Superfund sites, the Gowanus Canal and Newtown Creek. For many of these contaminated groundwater sites, is the current technology even capable of really cleaning them up?
So the National Research Council put together a report last year which showed, again, many of these systems or these technologies work well initially, but they reach this point where they stop working. And that includes pump and treat. That includes sort of more novel techniques like bioremediation, where you put yeast or bacteria into the ground and those live organisms then break up the chemicals. Or you put chemicals in that will break up the chemicals. They all have sort of their initial results, which are positive and good, but after a while, nothing works.
Well, Newtown Creek was a dumping site for a lot of different things, but there was also a major oil spill until the BP oil spill. It was the largest in North America, bigger than the Exxon Valdez. And I understand that oil has finally been pumped out of parts of Greenpoint, but what can be done with that oil? Can that oil be cleaned up and be used again?
So we focused on these things called volatile organic chemicals, which are very different than oil. I think oil is easier to separate from water, but it's a really interesting question. I know that there are bacteria that can break oil down, but again, some of those bacteria, and particularly the chemicals, as we all saw in the Gulf, can create new hazards of their own. And I have not looked into these two sites in any depth, so I don't know how they're treating the oil, but I'd be really interested.
Well, how much can a cleanup of a Superfund site of the sort that you looked into in Mountain View cost?
Millions. In Mountain View, we know that the companies cleaning up the waste has spent more than $100 million. That doesn't include the more than $10 million in EPA costs that they then asked the companies to reimburse them for. So, I mean, even a site, just one site or one collection of sites can cost hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, the EPA spends about $1.2 billion a year on the Superfund program, which actually is a small part of the total budget. But then they have to calculate whether a site is even worth cleaning up, don't they?
Right. And so they have, I mean, the typical process for a cleanup is that you, when it comes to groundwater, like the ones we focus on, is that the government wants you to clean these to the point where essentially they are restored. And in that by what they mean by that is that the drinking water can be drunk. The problem, and like you've seen in Newtown, I mean, you're building condos on top of this site in Newtown's case, and the site isn't, they're still cleaning it up. So, I mean, you can't, you know, if I mean, in California, we have a major drought going on here. You can't use that groundwater for decades, if not centuries, because it takes so long, like Suzanne said, to even reach a point where you can drink it.
Now, we have virtually no time left, but you note that the toxic trail doesn't have a single endpoint. Is it possible that certain wastes could just circulate throughout the system indefinitely, or wind up back in Silicon Valley where it began?
Yeah. So actually, if your listeners take a look at our story, we have a map up, and it shows in at least one case that's exactly what happens. The waste starts in Silicon Valley, it goes through several treatment areas, and then it actually gets sent back to Silicon Valley where there's a treatment plant designed to treat that kind of waste. So it's they called it back in the 1980s, and I love the term. It's a toxic merry-go-round. It just goes around and around and around.
Under those circumstances, might it be just as reasonable to leave some of these things where they are?
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the things we're questioning the EPA on. I mean, when you clean up these sites, you're contributing to this toxic merry-go-round. But as we've learned, if you leave it there, it's going to take several hundred years to clean, but that's no different than if you actually keep trying to clean it. So why don't we just call it a day, tell nobody to drink the water, and not contribute to this toxic trail any longer.
Suzanne Rust is an environmental reporter, and Matt Drange is a business reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Their report, Toxic Trail, is the first accounting of the hidden impacts of the Superfund program. And I thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been eye-opening, and I have to admit, just a little scary.
Thank you, Leonard. It's a real honor to be on
the show. Maybe
a
lot scary. Thanks.
Thank you.